And now,
great to be back.
Back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
Awesome.
And your host, Bill Frank.
My next guest is a renowned historian who, among other things, commentated on Prince William and Kate Middleton's royal wedding and with Matt Lauer and Meredith Vera of NBC's Today Show. We're going to focus our attention on The Greatest Generation as we discuss his latest book, The Storm of War. Dr. Andrew Roberts has written or edited about 12 books and appears regularly on radio and television around the world. He has recently lectured at Yale, Princeton, Stanford universities, and at the U.S. Army War College. In 2011, Andrew commentated on the royal wedding of Prince William to Kate Middleton following his well-received broadcast of the funeral of Diana, Princess of Wales, and Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, and, of course, the wedding of Prince Charles to the Duchess of Cornwall. Andrew holds an honorary doctorate from Westminster College in Missouri, which, coincidentally, was the same college that Winston Churchill delivered his speech in which he coined the phrase Iron Curtain. He has two children. He lives on Park Avenue in Manhattan with his wife, Susan Gilchrist, who is a managing partner for the corporate communications firm Brunswick Group, joining us from New York. Hi, Andrew. How are you today?
Hi. Great to be on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for being a subject matter expert. You've written an extensive 700-page treatise on the storm of war, and I'd like to start with an aspect of wars, particularly World War II, that's much approved and very important, and that was the air power and how important that was to the Second World War. Now, a lot of histories have sort of covered the various strategic air warfare decisions that were made in World War II. I want to go over several of them with you, if we can, please, starting with, right here in our own backyard in the United States, Charles Lindbergh, the famed aviator, actually advised the United States that Germany had air superiority with the Luftwaffe prior to the United States entering the war. Now, while that may have seemed true to Lindbergh at the time, Germany had made a fatal armaments mistake. Germany decided not to develop a four-engine bomber, and that was important and became critical to them later in the war. So in what ways did this decision alter the outcome of the war, particularly vis-a-vis the Battle of Britain?
Well, really what it meant was that their bombers could only spend about 20 minutes over London. They caused enough devastation, of course, when they did come over. They killed up to 50,000 Londoners and in the Blitz, and wounded, of course, many, many more. But had they been able to spend hours over the city, they could probably have blasted it into oblivion, which would have meant that we might have not been able to have continued the conflict.
Right, and that was a strategic change for Hitler.
Hitler made a lot of strategic changes, especially with regard to the air war. He actually, although he was presented, of course, by Joseph Goebbels, his Minister of Enlightenment and Propaganda, as an iron-willed Führer, in fact, he constantly changed his mind, and he did this also over jet aircraft. Had the Germans put everything into jet aircraft production, where they were absolutely neck and neck with your P-51 fighter plane, then it could have been very difficult and dangerous over the skies of Germany very late on in the war. As it was, Hitler kept creating bottlenecks of production by changing his mind about whether he wanted the jet to be a fighter or a bomber.
Now, that's interesting, too, because jet power, and that goes back to Charles Lindbergh's thesis that Germany did have air superiority. But the strategic use of aircraft is really where Germany fell down. Had Germany focused on bombing the radar stations along Great Britain's south coast, how would that have altered the Battle of Britain? How might that have altered the war?
Well, by the 25th of August 1940, the RAF, Royal Air Force, was on its absolute last legs. There were the most terrible huge craters in the runways. The command and control systems, as you mentioned, the radar systems, were at their last legs too. Had they continued to batter away at the aerodromes, then it could have been all over as far as the Battle of Britain was concerned. Instead, however, fortunately, a lone Heinkel 111 bomber dropped its bombs on London, allowing Churchill to respond the very next day and hit Berlin, which went to the very heart of what Nazism was all about, because the Führer had said that that Berlin was never going to be attacked. As a result, of course, he was shown not to be infallible, so he started to bomb the great docks of London from the 7th of September onwards, which allowed the RAF this crucial moment to repair the holes in the runway, to recreate the command and control systems. And that allowed us, in the end, to win the Battle of Britain, specifically a week later on the 15th of September, which is now commemorated as Battle of Britain Day.
And that it did. My guest is Andrew Roberts, author of the book, The Storm of War. And Andrew, that change of bombing the radar stations on the South Coast to actually bombing London, bombing civilian populations, led to Allied reprisals and Allied retaliation, including the much-talked-about fire bombings of Dresden, where we went over at night, we dropped incendiary bombs there, literally sucking the oxygen out of the city and killing people in multiple ways, either by burns or lack of oxygen. It was made very, very famous in Kurt Vonnegut's book, Slaughterhouse Five. Talk to us about the bombings of Dresden, because it's highly controversial. History revisionists have gone back and said we really didn't need to do that. In fact, did we need to bomb Dresden, or was it just retaliation?
Oh, no, we definitely needed to bomb Dresden on many grounds. The numbers that were killed at Dresden is has until recently been a very big debate. Goebbels said it was 200,000 people. The fascist historian David Irving also called it 180,000. Kurt Vonnegut, in his book, claimed it was in six figures. The fact is, as a new group of entirely objective German academic historians now state, it was something like between 18,000 and 20,000. So it was nothing like the numbers who died as we imagined. However, of course, an awful lot of Germans did die in the carpet bombing of German cities, Hamburg, of course, also being a hard-hit place. The reason that Dresden needed to be attacked was that it was the nodal point for the railway systems to get the German army from west to east, and occasionally lots of them from east to west as well. They needed to get into these railway sidings, which were based in Dresden. You also, of course, when you go to Dresden and look across the river at the railway sidings, you appreciate that from 10,000, 15,000 feet up, it's next to impossible to pinpoint accuracy hit precise buildings back in the February and March of 1945. The other reason, of course, that an awful lot of people died was that the Gauleiter of Dresden monstrously it's an incredible decision, but he didn't build shelters for the population. He actually built a very nice shelter for himself and his family and his staff, but not for the rest of the civilian population there, because he didn't think he was going to get hit. He should have, not least as well as the railway stations. You had big ophthalmic factories there, which were very helpful for German war industry. So it was a place that was going to be hit as soon as the bombers from the USAAF and the RAF were able to get that far into southern Germany.
All right, my guest is Andrew Roberts. We're talking about World War II. And Andrew, let's change theaters for just a moment and talk about the most controversial bombing of all of World War II. And that, of course, was the U.S. decision to drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Again, revisionist historians have gone back and said, probably didn't need to do that. We didn't know what we were unleashing at the time. Untold devastation, and of course it launched us into the Cold War and the atomic arms race that soon followed from that. However, other people have looked at this a little more objectively and said, no, we'd really needed to do something of this nature. Where do you fall in that discussion?
Oh, very much in the latter camp, very much. It seems to me unanswerable that the American Army's own statistics of a quarter of a million men that George Marshall and his senior advisor assumed would be killed if the United States had to actually land on the Japanese mainland makes the decision an open and shut case, frankly. You know, when one looks at what the Japanese did in defending Okinawa and Iwo Jima, sometimes in suicidal to the absolute last minute, they were fighting to the last round, these people. It was something, and these were islands. They weren't even the traditional homeland. They weren't part of the motherland of Japan. The fanaticism that the U.S. Army and Navy were facing in the last stages of the Second World War was such that I believe that a quarter of a million men, American soldiers, which is actually, of course, more than was lost in the whole of the rest of the war by America, is actually, if anything, an underestimation, and lots of historians agree with me on that.
Well, yes, I've read numbers as high as 750,000 American lives would have been lost if we had to invade the home islands of Japan in order to win that theater of the war. But let me play the devil's advocate, if I can, for just a moment, because we were, in essence, fighting the Japanese alone. The United States stood alone. Great Britain did their part in Burma and other theaters of the war, but in reality, we were the ones that were island hopping and making that march. By the time the war in Europe had ended, we now had two other allies, Great Britain and Russia, most importantly Russia, who could have joined the fray. Had those two countries joined in the fray and tried the battle for the home islands, how might that have influenced or even changed the course of the war?
Not a lot, frankly. The Russians did promise at Yalta that they would declare war against Japan and 3 months after the end of the war in Europe, and they did to the day. That wasn't in anything like, they didn't have anything like enough time to do anything more serious than grab the parts of Manchuria that the Japanese had already taken earlier on in the war. The British Navy was steaming towards the theatre, and Admiral King finally was persuaded, the U.S. Naval Chief of Staff was finally persuaded to allow the Royal Navy to take part, but we didn't have any active participation in Okinawa, Iwo Jima, or as you say, the island hopping. But Britain was a pretty bankrupt nation by 1945. The idea that we would be landing large numbers of men on the Japanese home islands is fanciful, frankly. So I'm afraid this was going to be an American operation. And the fact is that, of course, the Japanese had, by 1945, shown that they were so fanatically resistant to the concept of surrender that even after the first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, they refused to surrender. It took the second bomb 3 days later at Nagasaki on the 9th of August 1945 to persuade them. And so it seems to me that nothing short of this terrifying new, brand new device, which the Japanese could say to themselves, well, look, we're fighting a scientific invention that we just simply don't have the answer to. And they didn't know how many bombs the Americans had, of course. As it was, they only had two, with a few more in production. But it was a very close-run thing. It was extremely fortunate that so much time and thought and effort had gone into creating these terrible weapons, which did, after all, end the Second World War, a war which had lost, in the course of it, 50 million lives.
It's a staggering number. My guest is Andrew Roberts, author of the book The Storm of War, A New History of the Second World War. And Andrew, we're going to continue on the air power theme for just one more question, if I can, because you had mentioned saturation bombing of European cities. That was the United States and Great Britain's strategy in Europe to attack those cities and bomb civilian as well as military targets there. But my question to you is this: if that was our policy in the United States, why couldn't we have applied the same policy to Japan? By that point, we had forward air bases at Timien. That's where we launched the Enola Gay for the dropping of the atomic bomb. We had the B-29, which certainly had the range to spend hours over the home islands of Japan. Why wasn't strategic bombing and saturation bombing an alternative for United States and Allied air forces?
No, it was. It was undertaken. It was undertaken to quite a degree. 80,000 Japanese died in Tokyo, which is actually more than the number that died at Nagasaki. So you were undertaking some pretty. Kyoto was also flattened virtually. Your the USAAF has a really very impressive tradition when it comes to the. To the destruction of Japanese cities, and also they were very good against submarines as well. The Japanese submarine fleet was almost completely destroyed by the American USAAF. You have a fine tradition in that sense.
No, glad to hear it. My guest is Andrew Roberts. So, Andrew, back to the German and European theater for just a moment, and let's focus a little bit on Hitler, because he was really central to the whole story that you developed in the book. And I'm just going to ask the very simple question, was Hitler insane?
No, he wasn't insane, but probably right at the end of his life, when he knew that there was no chance of winning and when he knew that, therefore, he was going to die, that had a debilitating effect on him psychologically, as it would on anyone. But the idea that we can somehow write him off as a lunatic right from the time that he became Führer in January 1933 is frankly too much of an easy let out. He wasn't insane. If anything, actually, he had a relatively high IQ, it's estimated. He was a bit of a an obsessive when it came to, well, everything, as you can imagine, but specifically also when it came to things like railway gauges and the speed of aircraft and how much munitions a tank could carry and things like that. He was a bit of a sort of details man. And when he looked at the big picture of things, especially the big questions, he very often blundered terribly. He wouldn't listen to these strategic commanders, these far better strategists than he, men like Erich von Manstein and Erwin Rommel and Gerd von Rundstedt and Heinz Guderian. These men were able to see the war in a big picture in a much better way than him, but he would he'd listen to them for up to an hour there at the Führer conferences in the Wolfschanzer in East Prussia, and then he'd go and do precisely what he originally intended to do in the first place.
Well, it's interesting. Here are these men that were dedicated soldiers, many of them from the Prussian tradition, who were actually working with Hitler, leading the war effort. How and why would they ally themselves with Hitler? I mean, these are professional soldiers.
Well, that's why they did it. They were professional soldiers. They didn't think that they had any political duties. From 1934 onwards, the July of 1934 onwards, the entire German officer corps had to swear a personal oath of allegiance to Hitler. And that was the person that they admired, of course, ultimately, was General was Field Marshal von Hindenburg, but he died in 1934. And so from that moment on, where after they'd taken their oath, the vast majority of them stuck to it, and stuck to it pretty much to the end. Those very, very brave few, those ones who attempted to assassinate Hitler on the 20th of July 1944 and came to a grisly end as a result, are very much the minority.
Well, Andrew, let's get back then to a hypothetical question, if I can, please. Could or even should Hitler have won World War II based on all of the factors that you look at? He was a sane man, we've concluded that, and if he had listened to his advisors, could they have won the war?
Yes, they could have. I go into this in some detail, actually, in The Storm of War, the various ways in which he could have won the war. The key thing was not to invade Russia in the way that he did at the time that he did. The central statistic for me of the Second World War is that for every 5 Germans killed in combat, by which I don't mean being bombed from the air, I mean actually dying on a battlefield, for every 5 of them, 4 died on the Eastern Front. And so what we were doing, what Americans were doing, what the Canadians and the rest of the Western forces were doing was effectively killing the 5th German. But the way that the Wehrmacht was made to bleed was on the Eastern Front. In the month of July 1944 alone, no fewer than 530,000 Germans in Army Group Center alone were killed or wounded.
Wow.
So, yeah, you over 500,000 casualties there in Operation Bagration, one great Russian assault on Army Group Center. That was the key thing. So if you'd got the Russian attack right, and he could have, had he managed to get to the Caucasus and not have to come the full 1,000 miles or so from Poland all the way to Stalingrad, had Moscow fallen, which it very nearly did, Stalin had his personal train made ready on the 18th of October 1941 to take him back beyond the Urals. Up in the north there, Leningrad was subjected to an 850-day grueling siege in which 1.1 million people lost their lives. And then down in Stalingrad, of course, Stalingrad was captured by the Germans. So, you know, it was touch and go, and there were lots of different ways that Hitler could have won that war. And had he won that war and knocked Britain out of the Second World War, there are plenty of ways he could have done that by taking 80% of our oil production, by capturing Iran and Iraq, for example. Then you, the Americans, would have been faced with a world that was very, very hostile indeed, really, from the Urals all the way to Brest.
It's frightening to think what might have happened. My guest has been Andrew Roberts, author of the book, The Storm of War, A New History of the Second World War. Andrew, if people are intrigued by what you have to say, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
To my website, www.andrew-roberts.net.
Andrew, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you. I enjoyed it enormously.
Thank you.